Park Place meeting, talk given Thursday morning, 19th May 1977. We have spent the last two mornings in considering in depth the meanings associated with the two parts of our theme, Holy Day. This morning, we must start off with a consideration, somewhat briefly, of what makes the day unholy. First and foremost, its pleasure pursuit. This is ingrained in us through natural evolution and the nature of the body itself. We all know that the pleasure-pain mechanism of the body is essential for its survival and the maintenance of the body in a healthy state. But whilst, as far as the purely physical aspect, the body is concerned, the body automatically takes sensations which are pleasurable or which are painful in its stride. The process goes on naturally. The trouble comes with its psychical counterpart. Pleasurable impressions one likes, and unpleasurable sensations one dislikes. And the psyche builds up its attachment to pleasure sensations, its aversion to painful sensations. Now it wants to accept one part of life experience and reject the other part. The psyche does not remain in a state of poise. Therefore, the psyche does not take in pleasure and pain in its stride because of its immaturity, for one thing. This attachment and aversion brings about the desire and the planning. The intellect is now the servant of desire, the slave of desire, the planning to have more and more of pleasurable sensations. In our ignorance, we think that pleasurable sensations and working for them and trying to have more and more of them is real happiness, is bound up with fulfillment. Being in an ignorant state, not knowing that man is essentially a religious being and that his whole psychophysical organism and its life is to be lived always, all day, every day, in the service of the transcendent, the supreme God, use what name you like. Being ignorant of that, this pleasure pursuit blots out the true self-knowledge which ought to constantly operate within us. Pleasure in itself is by no means evil. In fact, it is a necessity for healthy existence. But then, nature, in this case, the instrument of the grace of God, if you like to put it in those terms, is constantly supplying us with right pleasure through the senses, all day long, every day of our lives. Not only through the senses, but through our cultural state and achievements. Art, science, philosophy, beauty, and all the rest of it. And this tide of happiness is pouring into us all the time. But because we develop this attachment to what gives pleasure, we degrade the transcendent nature of this happiness and try to hold it, to fixate it. And it is in the fixation that the trouble comes. Let it come, be thankful. Let it pass away. Painful sensations are bound to come also. That's the nature of existence, the duality. Pleasure, pain. All right? Let them come. Let it be realized that they are the gift of transcendence. They are opportunities. They are heaven-sent opportunities for us to learn. To learn more and more of ourselves, what we are like, and to learn in more intense measure, in deeper depth, that we live not for our separate selves, but for the fulfillment of that which is transcendent to us all the time. So you see, it is in that sense that the pleasure pursuit becomes an evil. To repress the pursuit of pleasure is a mistake. If we repress it, then we are setting up a conflict within ourselves from which we will never escape. Whatsoever pleasure in terms of our everyday natural existence brings to us, whatever pleasure comes, regard it also as a means for learning. Learning, learning, coming closer to the heart of reality. Then you will find that the experiencing of pleasure, the gift of God, if you like, is not evil. It is good. It is healthy. But the great thing, the great point we have to remember is not to grasp it, not to grasp at it, to keep hold of it, and to hanker for more of it. This is the root of the trouble. So this pleasure pursuit, in that sense, because of which the deep truth of our being and the purpose of our existence is put out of our mind. Take an example. of how it has worked in our own day and age. The organizing of holidays. And how easily our organizing of holidays is a disorganizing of the truly happy, holy day. Is it not? We are going to have this pleasure, that pleasure. We are going here, we are going there. Wonderful excitement. And what do? With the holiday? We expend our life energy. We squander that which does not belong to us. We squander it. We misuse it, our life energy. Then when we come back from the holiday, we need a good rest. And it's easy to see that the part played by the influence of inadequate and wrong upbringing and education in all this. After all, this passionate pleasure pursuit is something which is a conditioning influence from outside. Our parents, our friends, our society and its ways. Everybody has to have a holiday. It is just a routine, an imprisoning routine which has been set up. I never knew until I came to England for the first time that this business of having holidays was a routine. All my life, my young life in Ceylon, in Colombo, we never had a holiday in the sense that we organized a holiday. Oh, now where are we going for our holidays this time? We never had anything like that. The actual number of holidays I had all through my young years till 19 was 3. A planned going away for a few days, and we went away up country, as we call it, away from the heat of Colombo, 6,000 feet up, and there was a purpose behind it. Involved, it was partly health. Not that I as a little boy needed it, my parents needed it more than I did. And partly to acclimatize myself with a view to the future when I was coming to the cold country of England. These were the holidays. But there was nothing specially planned. We just went up country, walked about. 3 days we spent and we came back. Wonderful holiday we had. We did enjoy it, of course. But contrast that with the present worldwide business of organizing holidays. You see, we try and sell the divine if we possibly could. There is another aspect also which makes our day unholy. Our natural aggressiveness, which makes us self-obtrusive. Everything is done for the sake of the self. We draw the world unto ourselves. This is essential after birth until we have reached adulthood. When certainly the body has matured, but the mind has not even begun to mature. We acquire knowledge, but the acquisition of knowledge, the acquisition of skills and know-hows and so forth, is not wisdom. The crown of fulfillment for the mind is wisdom, is pure intelligence, the faculty to see the truth of things as they are, as we meet them. But the psyche never reaches maturity. Throughout the whole of life, where thousands of millions of people are concerned, only the few are gifted enough and have striven rightly enough to realize the maturity of the mind. And as you all already know, this maturity of the mind necessitates first and foremost the complete purification of the psyche. Therefore, we remain self-centered. The child has to acquire for itself in order to grow. But once it has grown, it has to outgrow its self-limitedness and realize its complete interrelationship with all beings around, with all the kingdoms of nature around, and allow this sense of transcendence which lies dormant within each individual to come to flower in such a manner that in the sense in which at the start Adam was on speaking terms with God, we are on speaking terms with transcendence everywhere. And the voice of the eternal sings its song of self-realization and life through each individual, which is a very, very different thing. Then there is no self-obtrusiveness at all. Our egoism, that is, and our vanity, we feed right through our lives. So this is what makes the day unholy. One has only to observe people, particularly in big crowded cities. Look at their faces as they pass by. Look at the manner in which they walk, the manner in which they talk, ill at ease, always in a hurry, furrowed brows, concerned with making that extra £15,000 somewhere, somehow, and always having the most marvelous and perfect excuses for it all. Always forgetting that you can't take it with you. And always forgetting that all that we acquire is not ours to possess. We are the trustees for what comes to us, whether it be immense wealth or whether it be cultural gifts or any particular skills which we may have. We are the trustees for it all, not to possess, not to aggrandize the self. And then, when one really sees that, the whole day is a holiday in the real sense, because we have made it holy. It's a very different thing. What is the fundamental root of this mad pleasure pursuit, this self-obtrusiveness? It is our state of ignorance. We must be very clear what we mean by the word ignorance in the religious context. Ignorance in the worldly context is not knowing algebra or chemistry or German or French or whatever it is. One is ignorant of it. Not knowing what's going on in Timbuktu or the wilds of Australia, that is the ordinary meaning of ignorance. But ignorance in the religious context is that state of consciousness in which the transcendent is completely absent. That is the supreme ignorance. We are unawake to the ultimate reality, to the ultimate truth. It's very, very important to understand this. Because once we really awake to that, it exercises the most powerful influence in changing our lives. We talk of the omnipresence of God. We talk about the infinite. Use the term void or plenitude. Use the word absolute. Or use the ordinary names which the people of the world have given to whatever they believe in as the supreme being. See, Ahura Mazda or Allah or anything you like. We talk of that. But how real is it to us? Do we really think, feel, speak, and act all day, every day, as if transcendence were here? Do we not constantly betray, deny the truth, the fact of the supreme waiting right within our being? Just waiting to be allowed to come forth. I have said over and over again at our meetings throughout the years, transcendence, God, use any word you like, never compels, but waits with infinite patience. Compulsion denies love. Denies true understanding, true wisdom. If there is real love, if there is real wisdom, there is no compulsion. And yet, the very fact that the transcendent is the absolute reality, by virtue of its perpetual existence in eternity, exercises an unceasing influence, a non-compulsive influence. This is the marvel of it. This is the beauty of it. This is one demonstration of grace in a wonderful form. The infinitude of such love and understanding is something our poor little brains can never grasp. We have to transcend the limitation of our brains and let this something profounder, which is pure mind, as for instance we find presented in Buddhism, come into play. Because pure mind is not my mind. There is the real fact of my psyche, which is the particular patterning and limiting of pure universal mind to fit into my particular constitution, especially my brain and nervous system and the activity of the ductus glands and so on. So there is no such thing as compulsion from transcendence, and yet it is the irresistible influence. But we have the ability, we have the power to shut it out. This is something special to man. The animal world can't do it, the plant world can't do it. They just live completely in accord with their own nature, the laws of their being. They cannot choose whether they will be angels or devils. They are just what they are. We have this power of choice, because when we, through our in our evolutionary process, began to awake to a sense of transcendence, we developed the faculty of looking within ourselves, recognizing our own self nature, and that we could exercise will and choice. And we have been trying to learn, not very successfully yet, for these 3 or 4 million years of our evolution, or whatever it may be, to use that power of choice intelligently, in cooperation with the Supreme Reality. In willing cooperation, in willing service. This is service in the highest sense. The true servant is the free man. He is not the slave. We are the slaves of our pleasure drive, our ignorance, our obtrusiveness. It is all this which makes our day unholy. And hence, we are not in constant communion. Otherwise, communion should be a constant state. Whatsoever we think, feel, speak, do, whatsoever we see, hear, touch, taste, remember, etc., in all that, through all that, we shall be aware of transcendence being here and now, omnipresent. We talk of the omnipotence, the all power. I said a few moments ago that transcendence is non-compulsive. It is in this very non-compulsiveness that omnipotence is displayed. Because non-compulsiveness is infinitely resilient. Can you or I hurt or destroy the infinitely resilient? You see? An infinite resilience for us as individual human beings means the complete freedom from selfness. We are not resilient because we want the self to remain the separate self, and therefore we offer a resistance to that which tries to upset the self and break up the self. But this selfness is the very thing that should dissolve away in order that the infinite resilience of the one and only Supreme Self may function freely. And when we do that, then we shall realize our unkillability. The body will of course decay, but the psyche, the soul, use what word you like, remains unkillable. It is the universal reality. The different material patterns and forms we see through the universe all come into being and all dissolve away. But primordial stuff, whatever it may be, out of which the entire universe comes into being, just remains that primordial stuff. The infinite cannot be increased, it cannot be decreased, because that is implied in the meaning of infinitude. These are some of the things we have to realize. So, as we grow and begin to see these things, we realize that we have to grow into the true person. And here, let us remind ourselves of that wonderful meaning of person, which is given in the Upanishads. You know, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, which is the greatest of the Upanishads, is pre-Buddhistic. There is that marvelous little paragraph in which the word person, Purusha in Sanskrit, is derived from Pur, which is the short form of Purva, meaning formerly. The Ush is the root, which means to burn up. And the Upanishad states that because in the beginning is a bad phrase, because it implies time, a moment for the beginning, a timeless moment for the beginning. In the beginning, Purusha, looking around and seeing nothing other than himself, said, "I am." And he is called Purusha because formerly it burnt up, and then the words which follow are sarvam papmanam, meaning all evil-mindedness. Now, the real meaning of the phrase "in the beginning" in the scriptures of the world is that state of awareness which you yourself can enter into in complete holiness, in the state of complete holiness, when you are in the ultimate communion, which is the peak point of contemplative prayer, the Unio Mystica, the peak point which is complete samadhi, the ultimate togetherness. This is something very real. And in this state, which is timeless and spaceless, try and feel out the significances of an existence which is timeless and spaceless. You see, in that state, which is the supreme that man can realize on earth, and which was realized by the founders of the great religions and those like them. There is this extraordinary awareness. And that state can be present only as and when all evil-mindedness has been completely burnt out, as the Upanishad says. But the burnt out really means has been transformed, utterly transformed into the pure holy state. And in this transformation process, do remember, nothing is destroyed. That's why the translation burnt out is slightly misleading. It's very difficult to translate into other languages. Nothing is destroyed, nothing is annihilated, but everything is utterly transmuted. The pure metal and the dross alike are transmuted into absolute perfection. So this is what person means. Purusha. We have to grow into that state. Reach out into that state. Not by our own efforts merely. Our effort is directed towards understanding what we actually are here and now and cleansing ourselves of the evil. Whatsoever is manifest is an expression of transcendence, actually. It is in itself perfect. Man introduces imperfection and evil in the world. Because once this sense, this power to look within oneself and be self-aware grew, and out of ignorance he used the strength of his own withinness to oppose the divine, then there came the fall, the obscuration of the divine in our own consciousness. It is one meaning, at least, of the fall. So we see how the day is made unholy. And to make it holy, we have to grow towards this condition of the Purusha. In Buddhistic terms, we find it as the Uttara Puriso, the further man or the beyond man. Here, taking in this context, man being understood as the ordinary worldling. The ordinary worldling is the Putujjano. The Putujjano has to, through the religious life, grow into the Uttara Purisho, the perfected man, the man made in the living image of God. Now, there was a Brahmin called Sundarika Purisho. Sundarika Bharadvaja. He went to see the Buddha and was deeply touched by the discourse which the Buddha gave. And then he asked the Buddha, "Do you go down to the Bahuka River to wash?" And the Buddha said, "What is there special in the Bahuka River?" And the Brahmin replied, But all Brahmins are taught that if you wash in the Bahuka river, you will be completely purified. And it is an auspicious day, a holy day, when you bathe in the Bahuka river. And the Buddha answers and says, not only in the Bahuka, but he mentions six other rivers which are also considered sacred rivers of that sort. And he says, not that way do you purify yourself. And it is not any particular day, the particular day on which you bathe in those rivers, which is therefore a holy day. And he says unequivocally, every day for the pure is an auspicious day, is a holy day. For the pure, every day is a holy day, a holiday in the religious sense. Then again, there is this wonderful sentence in the Dhammapada. The sun shines by day, the moon shines by night. The warrior shines in his armor, the Brahman by his meditation. But the Buddha, the enlightened one, the utterly purified, do remember the supreme characteristic, the utterly purified one, the Buddha, shines radiant both by day and night. By virtue of his very existence, he exercises this influence of spreading light. Non-compulsive again. This is the wonderful part of it. Shines by day and night. You remember, on Tuesday morning, I mentioned the Rig Vedic presentation of this in another form. The embodied as the god Savitar. Surya the sun by day, Mitra the sun by night, and Savitar the sun which shines both day and night. This is similar to that. The Buddha shines radiant both by day and night. See, we must listen to this sort of thing not merely with the brain. That, of course, one has to do. But not merely with the brain. Listen to such things. Study all scripture. Meditate or whatever it is with the whole heart. The essence of the mind. The heart in scripture means the essence of mind, the essence of that in us which understands everything. In the Zarathustrian calendar, every single day has the name either of an archangel or an angel. So in Zarathustrian religion too, we have this affirmation that every day in reality, from the religious point of view, is a holy day. All this involves the teaching of Ritta, which goes right back to the Rig Veda itself. And as you know, the Rig Veda is the oldest religious monument of all the Indo-European people. Ritta, the divine order which is inherent in all things. It's a most extraordinary concept, at least 4,000 years old. Ritta, this divine order which is inherent in everything. And if we read the signs of the transcendence writ throughout the universe, we will see this order, this cosmos, this process of manifestation and evolution in accordance with the laws of its own being. In accordance with the laws. Here, we must wake up to the fact that it is man, and probably man alone, who disobeys. In the theistic religions, we have this disobedience being taken right to the level of the angels, the rebellious angels, as they are called. I wonder whether that is the most constructive way of regarding it. In manifestation, the universe of manifestation, on the one hand, there are always the building up energies, the anabolic energies, and they are counterbalanced by the so-called destructive or catabolic energies, in order that the universal process may go on. Otherwise, you'll get a fossilized universe, stay put, permanently, static. If we look at it that way, we shall see that any sort of antipathy we may feel towards the demonic forces is a mistaken state of mind. They have their place. They have their purposes. Consider, for instance, we say that Judas betrayed Jesus. As I put it in my book, Judas was the son of doom. But could the Son of God triumphed but for the part that the son of doom had to play? And who tells him to play that part and gives him the signal that now is the moment? Jesus himself does it. It's extraordinarily significant and has profundity in it beyond the brain of man. So, Ritta, this divine order inherent in all things, embraces everything, that which is acceptable to us and that which is disagreeable to us. It's very, very hard to see these things. But if we do, then the love and understanding in their transcendent reality have a chance of flowering and manifesting through us, poor, finite mortals that we are. All religions teach, all without exception, make the day, and remember the day we regarded, one way of regarding it was to see it as our conscious life, and night as symbolizing our unconscious life. Make the day holy by meditation, samadhi, by prayer, contemplative prayer. Not just supplicatory prayer, but the contemplative prayer where the self dissolves, is taken up into the transcendent. By using the name of the holy, and it's interesting that particularly in Zarathustrian religion, you get that marvelous discourse. Of course, these things in those days were always put in the form of the divine dialogue. It was one of the most convenient and the finest form in which one could present these teachings. Make the day holy by the name of the holy. And Ahura Mazda answers Zarathustra when Zarathustra asks, what are the best means by which we may transform the ill into the well into the good. And our Mazda answers, our names are the most powerful instruments for that. And there's a whole list of names that he gives, amongst which is the word Ahammi, I am. Moses, Ehye Asher Ehye, the I am. The Buddha uses the term Ahang continuously. The Upanishads and the Rig Veda talk of Tad Ekam, that one, the one and only I am. And Ahang, the one and only undeniable I am, which has its supreme meaning only in universal terms. When you and I assert I am, we are asserting a separated self. And if we assert a separated self, we are asserting selfness. One of the roots of ill, of the ill state. So the day is made whole by intense, pure mindfulness, watchfulness, the Sammāsati of the Buddha and the Sammāsamādhi, and Jesus's watch and pray. For you know neither the day nor the hour when the Son of Man, the Son of Mind, man, mind, are derived from the single root man and manyate in Sanskrit. You see, by faith, we talked of faith yesterday. Was it? Oh, the day before. Faith, the real meaning of faith, the deep meaning of faith. By dedication to the Supreme in our daily work. Thus, the ways of our little self, our ill self, as also the ways of transcendence through us, are seen. And thus too, this existential self is released out of selfness. Freed from selfness. Then one can make the day, then one is inevitably making the day holy by constant awareness of communion in the cosmos. It is we who get out of communion. Nothing in the cosmos is out of communion, but that is an unconscious communion. It is through man that this extraordinary thing, a conscious communion, can come into being. Because man has this power of looking within. And the withinness completely dedicating itself to the transcendent without produces the communion which characterizes man's communion as contrasted with the perpetual unconscious communion of nature within itself. We are the ones who are capable of injecting the excommunicated state through our ignorance, through our isolative self-consciousness and desire. Just one last word. You know, we say goodbye when we part. God be with you. In Germany, walking in the mountains and so on, this marvelous greeting, Grüß Gott. God is greeting God. Am I correct? That meaning is correct, isn't it? God is greeting God. It's an affirmation of the presence of transcendence within us, greeting transcendence outside this particular manifestation, in that particular manifestation. If this greeting becomes our daily state, will we not greet everything and anyone in that state of full awareness of the omnipresent divinity? And if we are really awake to it, what room is there for hate, for evil, for wrongdoing? What room is there for unholiness? We have made the day completely holy.